Hello and welcome back to Horror from the High Desert. I am your host, Scotty Milder, and this week my guest is author Rachel Eve Moulton. So Rachel Eve Moulton earned her BA from Antioch College in Ohio and her MFA from Emerson College in Boston. Her work has appeared in Beacon Bellowing Arc, Chicago Quarterly Review, Cream City Review, Bryant Literary Review, Narrative, Southwest Review, New Ohio Review, But Nye Review, The Bangalore Review, among other publications. Her debut novel, Tinfoil Butterfly, was long listed for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize and nominated for both a Shirley Jackson Award and a Bram Stoker Award. Her second novel, The Insatiable Volt Sisters, was named as one of the top 10 horror novels of 2023 by the New York Times Book Review. She spent most of her life as an educator, writer, and editor. She lives with her husband and two daughters in the mountains east of Albuquerque. I do want to remind everyone again to check out the show Nighttime Logic. That is the YouTube series hosted by friend of the pod, Daniel Brom. He is the author of The Night Marchers and Other Strange Tales and The Serpent Shadow from Cemetery Dance. The series focuses on the strange, weird, and wonderful side of dark fiction through readings and discussions with diverse authors from around the world. You can tune in on Daniel's YouTube channel, which is his name, Daniel Brom, or at Daniel Brom 7838. The next episode is going to be on April 23rd. 3rd at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and that's going to feature Douglas Ford and Jeff Ford. The episode after that's going to be on May 28th at 7 p.m., and that's going to feature Paul Tremblay. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please go to whatever streaming platform you're using. Leave 5 stars, leave a review, go to social media, spread the word, tell your friends. And here we go with Rachel Eve Moulton. So this is exciting because, as we were just saying, we're almost neighbors.
Yeah. You're in the city, right?
Yeah, I'm here. Oh, wait, hold on real quick. Getting some weird.
Not me, right?
Nope. That was my speaker cable was touching something. Yeah, no, I'm here in Albuquerque. And you're over, we don't need to be too specific, but you're over in the East Mountains, I think, right?
Yeah, we moved here almost 6 years ago soon and moved up into the mountains and love it here. So I do miss, I was living in a city before. I was living in Providence, Rhode Island. So I do miss, I miss that a little bit, but it's so gorgeous up here that it's, who cares?
Yeah. Yeah, and I live over, I mean, this won't mean anything to anyone who's not in this area, but I live over in kind of the Four Hills area of Albuquerque.
Oh, so, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You're close. Yes.
Yeah, we're close. I'm right basically at the mouth of the canyon, which is the entrance to the East Mountains. So
Yeah. It's nice there.
Yeah, it's most of the time when you're driving between Santa Fe and Albuquerque, you take the boring way, which is I-25, just straight up. But I like to take the back way, which is up through the East Mountain. So I kind of go,
yeah,
I
think, on the turquoise trail.
The turquoise trail, exactly.
Yeah, you'll just let us know when you're driving by, and I'll bring you a Americano or something so you can get all the way to Santa Fe. Literally would just step out, like walk a half mile to the road and just...
Yeah, it's a beautiful drive up that way. And then Madrid, there's a little town called Madrid, which is one of my favorite places. It's, when I was a kid, it was really spooky. It was basically abandoned. It was like an abandoned little ghost town. And then now it's been kind of taken over by the hippies and the artists. And so it's like a little kind of artsy town.
It's thriving. And, you know, I grew up in a small town in Ohio called Yellow Springs. And it is also a little hippie town. And so one of the first things when I first got here and was trying to figure out like where I belonged, I hit Madrid. And there's many arguments about which is right, but I'm trying to go with Madrid.
The locals call it Madrid. That properly should be called Madrid, but
I know, but I'm from Ohio where there's like, what do we call it, Versailles and you know, whatever. So but it's really, it's a lovely little place, and I grew up in that sort of town with a strong sense of community and lots of arts, and so it did make me feel a little bit more like, okay, I'm where I'm supposed to be. And during the pandemic, I actually finished revisions on Volt by renting this old miner's cabin just to get alone for a little while in Madrid and finish up. So.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I've actually thought about, every so often I like to get out of the city. Albuquerque is, sometimes the vibe here in Albuquerque gets a little bit, a little intense. Weird for writing, a little intense.
Little intense.
And sometimes I think like I gotta go like get like a Airbnb up around Madrid or something. Just take like a writer's weekend or something.
You should, because it's like it's actually affordable and there's food and coffee. It's a really, I like working when there are people around, but I don't have to interact with them. And that it gives you that. You can say hi, you can walk around, do your errands, and then hide. Really nice.
And then go to the mine shaft, get a burger.
The burgers are good. They're actually very good. Yes. Yes.
So, well, before I do want to kind of talk about like what brought you out here, but before we get there, I guess we should go back in time and just kind of talk about sort of, I always like to kind of start with just people's origin stories. You say you're from Ohio, which I also have Ohio connections. My
Oh,
dad,
do you?
yeah, my dad's from Cleveland, so
Right.
I have I was excited to read The Insatiable Volt Sisters with the whole Lake Erie connection and
Do you
everything.
know
So
Kelly's Island? That's what Fowler is based on, is
I've
Kelly's
heard
Island.
I've never been there, but I've heard of it. So, and I
I don't
know and
know.
I've been to some other Lake Erie island. I'm kind of familiar with.
I think there are other ones that are more popular than Kelly's Island.
I
I
think I've
adore
been to
Kelly's
one that I
Island.
think was bigger than what you described. I don't remember
And
what it was called. It was when I was a kid. I remember taking a ferry out to one
I could come
somewhere.
up with a name in a second here. But yeah, Kelly's Island is more modest. I found it through a writers group or a retreat of Cleveland, mostly Cleveland writers who were going up there, because Yellow Springs, where I'm from, is south, Southern Ohio, more near Dayton, Cincinnati. And came upon Kelly's Island in college, maybe graduate school. I can't remember exactly when it happened, but it's a very small, haunted, strange little place with not a ton going on. And so I've just always been kind of fascinated by it. So that's where Fowler
It
came from.
reminded me because I went to, and I believe, I mean, and again, jumping ahead a little bit, but I believe you went to school in Boston as well, right?
Yeah, I went to Emerson for graduate school. Yeah.
Because I went to grad school at BU, and I remember
Oh,
going
nice.
to taking some trips to up to Maine and taking a ferry out to some spooky islands off the coast of Maine, and it kind of had the same, almost the same feel.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I love about it too, I mean, people poke fun at Ohio and it kind of deserves it, but it's this, no one expects there to be an island w connected to Ohio, which is what I like. So if you're living on the East Coast and you're in Boston, there are islands you can get to and nobody thinks that's weird. Block Island is a popular one when you live in Providence and it's gorgeous and unique, but to have an island connected with Ohio to me seems sort of absurd in a great way.
Well, and there's something about the Great Lakes that there's something specifically spooky about the Great
Yeah,
Lakes. I think that, they were
exactly.
carved by, out by glaciers and, they're these big, enormous bodies of water just kind of right in the middle of a continent, kind of leftover oceans that are just these kind of remnants that are just sitting there. And
Yeah.
it's very unique and almost uncanny in a way,
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. You get it. Yeah.
I love that because and that's one thing, getting the Tinfoil Butterfly as well. I mean, I think both with Insatiable Volt Sisters and Tinfoil Butterfly, your ability to capture a sense of place is just and it's something I've talked with other writers about. I've talked with Gwendolyn Kaist, who's also got Ohio
Yes,
connections,
love her.
and Douglas Ford, who writes about Florida,
Okay.
and just that capturing a locale. And it's something, being a New Mexico writer, writing about the Four Corners region and writing about this area so much, I'm always trying to capture that sense of like locale, that sense of really wanting to paint a picture of a place for people who haven't been here and kind of
Yeah.
almost the surreality of a place that is so unique and so different. And I know that Lake Erie region, but like with Tinfoil Butterfly, I've never actually, well, I guess I have been to the Black Hills once.
Yeah.
But it was just a family trip, when I was in high school. And just your ability to like create this evocative, almost surreal kind of otherworldly atmosphere is really fascinating.
Thank you.
So, going back to just kind of your history. So you're from Yellow Springs. You said that's kind of the Dayton area.
Yeah, Yellow Springs is this little 4,000, just under 4,000 people college town. It's where Antioch College is.
Okay.
And my father went there in the late 60s, and then that my parents just kind of stayed. And so I grew up in this little artsy town where you kind of knew everybody and they knew you. Mostly that was good. And we also had famous people from that town. So I grew up really idolizing Rod Serling, went to Antioch College. He did wrote The Twilight Zone.
Oh, okay. Yes, right.
There's a wonderful writer who mostly did young adult fiction, but her name was Virginia Hamilton. She wrote this book called The People Could Fly. Suzanne Clauser, who had written for Bonanza or something, but then she wrote a book called A Girl Named Sooner. So I grew up in this kind of lore of what it meant to be a writer, and also a fascination with place, because I grew up in this same place with all these stories. And I think that has really infused my writing. And so Tinfoil Butterfly comes out of, I did stay in my town to go to Antioch College, but Antioch is a college that they call it cooperative education. So you work, you study, and then you work. So the first time I moved to Boston was because I was in college and I went to wanted to live in a city and get a job. So I got college credit for working at Urban Outfitters on Newbury Street, which is ridiculous.
I remember that very Urban Outfitters.
Yes, I bet. That's why I said it, right? We were instructed very clearly not to speak to customers unless they spoke to us. We were very like uppity and cool. But so I kind of did that. And Tinfoil Butterfly actually comes out of a trip I took for college credit again, where my friend and I drove across country and ended up in the Black Hills and the Badlands. And I kind of, felt such a strong connection to that place that I knew a character had come from there, and I kind of wanted to figure out what happens, who's here, how does the present impact these characters, how's the past. And it was in the 90s when that book is set, when I first discovered that space. So yeah, so I did that, and then I went to Emerson for grad school, and so I lived in Boston again, which was wonderful. Very different than Ohio, very different than Albuquerque, its own space. And after I graduated from Emerson, got an offer to teach back at Antioch. So then I went back and I was taught fiction writing for a couple of years. And then I got into private schools and that took us out to Rhode Island. And yeah, so it's been a journey. We ended up in New Mexico because my husband went to New Mexico Tech and has always been in love with New Mexico. So he was offered a gig out here and I sold tinfoil at the same time. It's a short version of the journey. So I was like, all right, let's ditch what we're doing. Let's move to New Mexico. Let's calm down out of the East Coast, and I'll be a full-time writer, whatever that means. And he'll have a good job opportunities out here. So now we're here.
Yeah, and so it's been about 6 years, you said.
Yeah, I think in July it'll be six for me and my girls. I have two daughters. Yeah.
What I found, because I grew up out here. And I went to college in Colorado, which was not that big of a shift. New Mexico to Colorado is kind of,
Yeah.
I went to you grew up in a small town, New Mexico, grew up in Los Alamos, and then
Yeah.
went to
Nice.
Alamosa, Colorado, which is an even smaller town than Colorado. And I lived in Denver for a while, which is a city, but it's a
Yeah.
Western city, so.
Correct.
And then I moved to Boston, and it was such a culture shock for me.
Was it for grad school you went?
It was for graduate school. Yeah,
Nice.
it was for screenwriting.
Oh,
And
wow.
I'm wondering, like, what was because almost now you did grow up, I guess it sounds like Yellow Springs was a small town in Ohio,
So
but
small, so small.
was it like a culture shock in reverse to come to New Mexico, like to go from Boston to like then the wide open spaces of to move out west, like.
Yeah, I mean, I think the last place we were, I was working in a wonderful private school in Providence, Rhode Island, and Rhode Island is tiny. Like,
But it's kind of dense, my
it is
memory is
dense. You have access to a lot. There's a lot of people, but like, there's this very, and the pace is fast. It is Boston-like in some ways. I don't know if they'd appreciate that or not. And then you go to New Mexico, and it's just very relaxed. Some mostly great, sometimes to the point of annoyance. So much space. Like I was commenting to a friend, I've gotten so spoiled going from East Coast to here, right? If I get to a trail in the morning with my dogs and there's already one car in the lot, I'm like, well, this is ruined. I can't do this. So like it's just I think last summer I actually commented on humidity. I thought it was humid here, and I was like, oh my gosh, I've lived in New Mexico too long. It's not humid. So there's things about it that I've already started to take for granted because it feels like home. And it was a culture shock. I mean, I love living in different places, getting a sense of them, but it was hard. It was like when you're in Rhode Island and you're in this little place. I remember when we first moved there, I was like, "Is there a Trader Joe's?" And they're like, "No, you don't want to go there. That's so far." It turned out it was like 10 minutes away, and that was too far a drive. In New Mexico, they're like, "Oh, there's a soccer tournament this weekend in Phoenix." And you're like, "That Phoenix, Arizona? Like 7 hours? Do I need a hotel?" Oh, okay. So there was kind of like that understanding of distance is completely different.
That was the thing I really noticed when I moved out east was talking to my friends who are from the east, but one of my best friends who's been on the podcast, my friend Mandy, she's from New Jersey and lived in Boston. And I just remember talking to my friends and for them it was like a 20 minute traveling to anywhere was like so far away. And I'm like, an hour commute in New Mexico is, I mean, that's
Nothing.
normal,
Yeah.
like
Yeah. It's kind of,
that's nothing.
yeah. We have a track meet next weekend and it's an hour and a half away and we're supposed to be there by 7 a.m. I'm like, okay, great. A New Englander would be like, middle finger. Like, no way. I'm not doing this.
I mean, I remember I could not get used to this was before when I lived in Boston, was before we had like GPS or smartphones. So we were actually
Me
looking at
too.
maps and stuff. And I could not get used to like the legend on the map to like figure out
Yes,
distances because it was like
I
everything looked
bet.
so far away. And I was like, oh wait, no, that's a half mile. Like I would be used to like, no, that's like
That could be
five
3 hours.
hours
Yeah,
away or
that's
something.
right. Yeah, and every time you move to a new space, I mean, there's just a whole different culture. And as a writer, it's like, people are unaware of the culture they're living in or what they've created. So like there's a certain language they're using or a set of movies they've seen or books they've read. And when I got to grad school, Boston had this whole like, canon that they just, not in a rude way, but they just assumed that you had the same one. And so then you're scrambling to figure it out because you're from Ohio, and then you moved to New Mexico, and there's a whole different canon or whatever it is, and all that stuff is super interesting to me.
So growing up, it's interesting reading your work versus some of the other writers I've had on here, because I would put your, reading Tinfoil Butterfly and Insatiable Volt Sisters. And I've read, like, I just this morning read your short story, Deluge, which is on your website.
Oh, thank.
And
Thank you.
I mean, you're definitely, your work falls in, I would say, like the literary side of the horror world. And so
Yes.
I'm very curious what your early influences are, because I think for a lot of us who are more in the like straight genre influences, it's like Stephen King, Clive Barker, all the same names that kind of get repeated a lot. But I read your stuff and I would like I feel like I see like William Faulkner, I feel like I see like Toni Morrison, I feel like I
Thank
see
you.
like I'm just really curious, like how much of the horror influence early on came in, and how much were like literary writers, like where were those early influences for you, and
Thank you
where
for
did
asking.
you find horror, like, and how
Yeah.
much do you define yourself as a horror writer? I know I've seen you, I think on your website you do call yourself a horror writer, so.
I do. I call it literary horror, feminist horror, and the genre stuff. Well, it's so ridiculous. I mean, you have to sell stuff, so you've got to pick something. But and I respect that. But it also feels like, I mean, Stephen King is certainly writing literary fiction much of the time, right? So, but it is a thank you for asking that question because it is something I really, when I was growing up, from very early age, was reading and watching everything I could get my hands on. And, I would purposely read things that I considered literary. So I would read Faulkner and then I would read Stephen King and then I would read Middlemarch and then I would read Dean Koontz. What he called his name was at the time, or then I got into Anne Rice, and then in between Anne Rice, I'm reading Tolstoy. So like I would, it had in my mind, not judgmentally, but I definitely had in my mind, I'm going to read these things that I'm supposed to know, whatever they are, and I like those, and then I'm also going to read what entertains me. And they weren't exclusive. I mean, both are entertaining, but it was like consuming a Stephen King novel or Anne Rice or thinking of other things. It just was so satisfying. And I would be drawn to that dark stuff. I didn't like slashers. I had a really hard time with horror movies. When I was younger. Now I'm open for it, but psychological thrillers were really interesting, psychological horror, things like that. And so I really worked on reading everything I possibly could, and then, learning that, what about that genre of horror I really enjoyed. And I wasn't drawn to science fiction in the same way, although I've read it, and I wasn't drawn to fantasy in the same way. So it was very distinct. But I definitely thought I was a literary writer, and that's how I was trying to sell my work. It wasn't until I met my current editor who worked with me on Tinfoil, and she was the one who said, "What if we sold this as horror?" And it did kind of click. I was like, "Okay, that's what I love." And it completely makes sense. So I needed that little push to be able to really identify the line I was walking and what kind of stories I wanted to tell. Does that answer
Interesting.
it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's
Okay.
interesting because, I would say like Tinfoil Butterfly. I read both Tinfoil Butterfly and Insatiable Volt Sisters last year. And then I just reread Insatiable Volt Sisters for
Thank you.
this interview. And Tinfoil, and they're both my favorite books I read last year, actually.
Oh, thank you. That's awesome.
But Tinfoil Butterfly to me was the one that it felt like it was the most genre non-specific of the two. Like
Oh, interesting.
it felt like it had a lot of kind of Southern goth, even though it's set in the Black Hills. But it felt like it had a lot of kind of Southern Gothic kind of feel to it. Talk a little bit about that book. I mean, you talked a little bit about, the road trip that kind of inspired it, but where was the spark for that, and where did the characters come from, and just how did that one develop?
So that one, I mean, it's a book that existed for a long time until, it found its current form. But I definitely, we went on that road trip. We were in the Badlands and the Black Hills, and I had never seen anything like that. And I was very taken. And I was like, okay, who what story is here that I could tell? What characters would be here? I then went back to college, and I think that part of what happened was I was in a playwriting class, and I was supposed to come up with two characters. So I was already in love with that setting. And then I found a photo from a magazine of a little boy wearing a tinfoil mask and another photo of a woman smoking a cigar. And so the assignment was kind of like put those two people into dialogue. And so the book came out of probably a very poorly written scene of a play and got put away. And then in graduate school for my thesis, I went back to it and I turned it into a novel, which I would have told you was literary. Then I put that away for a while. Other things happened in my life. And when I got so busy that I had no time to really be creative, I went back and looked at it, tore it up, made it more horror. And that's where it is. But that original spark was based on place and this idea of these two characters, who are they and what conversation are they having? And it's pretty much, I mean, I've been working on a screenplay for Tinfoil. And I mean, it's very clear to me that that's what's happening, that it's these two people come together in this scenario, in this place that they can't control, and what comes out of that.
I kind of love that because I love it. Almost reminds me, I'm going to get very, this is like very heady, kind of almost like film theory.
Okay, go.
It reminds me of like when you talk about the Eisenstein, Sergei Eisenstein, or Sergei, I guess, Eisenstein, and his theory of montage, which is you take one image and you take another image, and on their own, like an image means one thing, and the second image means one thing. You take them and you set them side by side, and together they create a third meaning,
I love it. I love it. Yeah.
and then if you add a sound to it, then that creates its own fourth meaning.
That's
So it's
right.
like, the image of the boy wearing the tinfoil mask, well, that just kind of means one thing on its own. But with the image of the woman smoking the cigar, well, this creates its own narrative. And then,
And then you
that
fill it in.
spark, that connection creates the story.
And I'm always interested, as you can tell from Volt, is like I'm interested in relationships. And so I knew I had this character from that picture, Emma, who wasn't necessarily likable. And I was like, okay, how can she take this anger she has and still become someone likable or come out of this better than she enters the si situation? And that's where you're like, okay, Earl needs her. She needs Earl. So.
Well, and I love, this is, when I teach film and I teach screenwriting at the community college in Santa Fe.
Yeah,
And
I did know that. I looked it up. That's cool.
well, and one thing I'm always trying to emphasize to my students is that, I don't care what genre you think you're writing, is that every movie or every story you're telling is a relationship movie. And every character interaction is it's a relationship story, whether it's father son, husband wife, boyfriend, whatever, every interaction on screen, it's about the relationship between the characters. It's really not about the plot. The plot is almost incidental to the relationship, and that the plot should grow out of the relationships. And I think that's what I loved about Tinfoil Butterfly is that there's a lot that happens in that story. And I don't want to get into spoiler territory, but it's really that relationship between Emma and Earl is that's the core. There's a lot of horrifying, disturbing things that Emma encounters through her. I mean, well, give us the setup for people who haven't read, just kind of give us the setup for Tinfoil Butterfly. We don't have to
So
get into the weeds. I don't want to spoil.
the deep dark secrets. Emma Powers is, like 18 years old, and she's running away from the Midwest, where she's, had a terrible time, done terrible things. She doesn't understand love. She's been sick. She's recovering from surgery that she shouldn't have had at that age, and she's just heading to the Badlands because her best friend slash stepbrother and her had this plan that this was going to be the place that they would discover themselves or kill themselves, whatever came first or more naturally. And so her brother, she's lost her friend, her stepbrother, and is headed out to end her life, really. And when she gets there, other things have happened, other mistakes have been made, and she meets this little boy in the middle of the Black Hills, and they're both kind of desperate and in need. And so my intention is, I'm very interested in love stories, and of course it's a child and an adult woman, so it's not a love, romantic love, but it's a love between these two people and how that love can develop and how it can save you from yourself and from outside circumstances. And so that's what I was really interested in. And Earl has his own horrific situation and is also creepy, so not entirely, a
He's
child can't be at
a
fault,
creepy
but he's
kid.
not innocent. He's creepy. We don't trust him right away, and he's not necessarily likable himself at first. So they meet each other and figure out how to like themselves most of all, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it. And it's essentially Emma gets sort of stranded at this diner, and that's where she meets Earl. And then
Yes.
Earl essentially asks her to help him with a situation.
With, yes, a task that no one would want to help with, right?
Exactly. And
It's
we
not
should
safe.
say, and Earl is the child with the tinfoil
The
butterfly.
mask. Correct. Thank you so much.
And then beyond that, I don't want to spoil anything
It did
else, but
go through lots of iterations, though, where, like, even as a thesis, it was like, is this stuff really happening, Rachel? Or is it in her head? Is she crazy? And I think what horror, identifying it as horror, gave me the opportunity to be just like, yep, this is happening. That's what's happening. That kid's real. The crows might be human. I mean, it was just like, okay, great, done. And that has been really wonderful in terms of identifying as a horror writer. Is like those things, the dark corners of my imagination. I'm no longer pretending that they're just metaphorical or literary. It is what it is, and this is how I see the world. And in the world of my books, they can come, that can be fact.
That's interesting because, I have, my thing about horror often is that I think people who like to shy away from horror or judge horror from
Yes.
afar, or like to, they don't want to admit that they like horror sometimes. And so they'll be like, no, it's a supernatural thriller or,
Sure it is.
whatever. They'll try to justify it by, hiding behind the metaphor of it or whatever. And those things can be present. I mean, Horror
Absolutely.
definitely allows for allegory and all of these things. But one thing that I think can often kill horror is this, or kill the effect of horror, is this instinct to want to rationalize it, to over-intellectualize it,
Yes.
to get a to try to use the front part of your brain and to be like super smart about it all the time and to forget the lizard part of your brain, which is just
Yeah.
that visceral, like it's about a
Run.
visceral reaction. And so I love that what you were just saying about like allowing yourself to just embrace the literal aspect of it, you know, that like no, this is, you don't have to justify, you don't have to justify, it's just, it is, like it's whatever it is, it's happening.
I love movies like that. There's one called, it's not The Relic, but there's one called Relic. It's a female cast. And really, it's about a woman and her daughter going back to take care of her mother who's suffering from dementia.
Oh,
So
I've heard
there
of this.
is,
I haven't seen it,
yeah,
but
it's
yeah.
so gorgeous. And it's so upfront. And it is also so horrifying. The grandmother like carves candles. And so there's really disturbing images around that. But I like movies and books that are unapologetic about that. This is horror, and it's also, I mean, there's so much horror in our daily regular lives. It is sometimes easier to dig into it through that lens of let's actually show it as scary as it feels as it's happening. So I
And
do like that.
just accept that it is, you know,
Yeah, yeah.
don't try to obfuscate it with a lot of kind of academic
No. Yeah. Yeah, there's extra rooms in the house, just like there's extra rooms in your mind. Let's not worry about it. Let's just be freaked out as she crawls through these spaces. It's like, oh my gosh, what's happening? So,
Well, and I think you're thinking about the story of yours that I read, Deluge, and I think Tinfoil Butterfly and Insatiable Volt Sisters all kind of work on this level. I thought Deluge was interesting because it gets more and more strange as it goes, and it's about a pregnant woman basically surviving a flood. You know, she's kind of left home alone as this flood is just like sort of encircling her house, and then she finds a strange creature,
Yeah,
object,
sure. Creature, I would say. Yeah.
creature. I mean, it seems to be a living thing,
Yeah.
and things just get weirder and weirder and weirder. And I wouldn't even necessarily say it's frightening, it's disturbing in a way.
Yeah.
But what I loved about it is that there's no attempt to justify any of it. It's just like it just happens, and it just, all the weirdness just keeps happening. And it's that balance between like it feels very natural, it unfolds very naturalistically, and yet it's very strange and very surreal. And I think Tinfoil Butterfly has a similar kind of thing where it's like it gets very strange, and yet it's just, we kind of accept it. We kind of
Yeah,
accept
good.
each sort of step in the process of the narrative.
Well, I also think you spend your life kind of figuring out what's strange about you. And so you assume for large chunks of time that the way you see the world is the way people see the world. And when you start letting yourself say, no, this isn't exactly how everybody else thinks about it, I'm just going to go for it. There's a real big freedom in that. It's like, it's not average or normal. It's you. And so art, like writing for me, lets me figure that out. This is how my brain works, and to not be apologetic about it and
Yeah, I love that.
push forward. Yeah.
Yeah. This is why be, I'm the same way. Just why be apologetic? These are the weird ideas I have. Here it is. Take it or leave
Well,
it.
and then when people say too, the other thing I struggle with is like people are like, oh, what do you write? And then you're like, horror. And they're like, oh, I can't do that. You get that answer a lot. And I'm like, yes, you can. Like, so like sometimes I'm juggling, like, how should I answer that question so they don't immediately decide they can opt out? Like, if I say literary fiction, they're gonna be like, oh, cool. There's a chance that they might not decide it's not for them. And when you say horror, and I'm like, I was just working with teaching a class with some high school students, and I'm like, there's all kinds, and like horror itself is like, there's all kinds of things. So when you tell me you don't watch it, what are you telling me? You don't watch slashers? You don't watch sci-fi because people confuse them? It's like, what are you saying to me? And the world is really, really scary place. So you can handle a horror novel. I mean, you're all right.
Yeah, well, and it's and people have such a circumscribed idea of what horror is. You know, you say horror, people think like you said, slasher or whatever. But it's
Or jump
like,
scares. I'm like, I don't know exactly. I've learned to be like, well, what do you think I just said to you? Like, what is it that you're not going to read? Because you do get slightly different. They've, I don't watch Friday the 13th versus I saw Midsommar and I haven't gotten over it yet, And you're like, okay, I got it.
But it's like, think about like, I mean, I mentioned William Faulkner. I think, I think you can make an argument that The Sound and the Fury is a horror novel. I think definitely people have made the argument that Toni Morrison's Beloved is a horror
Oh,
novel.
absolutely, it's a horror novel and I adore it. And Flannery O'Connor, she writes horror. Shirley
Absolutely.
Jackson, it's all, and Margaret Atwood, it's all horror.
I mean, what is the Flannery O'Connor story? A Good Man Is Hard to Find? That's
Oh
absolutely
my,
a horror story.
it's terrifying. And it's so good. And it's all gothic and dark, all her stuff. And yeah, absolutely.
And that what I think the Joyce Carol Oates story I think of, and I'm forgetting the name of it. It's the one it's inspired by the Pied Piper of Tucson, and I'm forgetting the name of the story. But it's often collected in literary fiction magazines. But it's possibly the most terrifying short story I've ever
Yeah,
read.
she can be very scary, and she's a literary writer. So that,
So it's
yeah, people are reading that. So yeah, it's interesting.
Well, let's move on to the Insatiable Volt Sisters. And I would say, it seems like, Tinfoil Butterfly, like I said, I loved the book. I mean, I read it and was just totally captivated by the characters and everything. But it seemed like with Insatiable Volt Sisters, you really did embrace like, okay, now I am a horror writer. I'm gonna like just dive in. This is full on a horror novel. I mean, you embrace the supernatural. But it's still very literary. I mean, I think it's still got that literary influence. It's also very, it reminded me very much of Shirley Jackson.
Oh, thank you.
I think I was thinking very much of We've Always Lived in the Castle. Just talk a little bit about, I guess, give us the setup for that. What the again, maybe just the setup and then avoiding spoilers, of course.
Well, again,
And
I
then
think
talk about where that one kind of came from.
I think I have often that sense of place comes first. So I had this writers group that we'd go to Kelly's Island, we'd rent a weird house and work for the weekend. And there's a quarry behind the house. Like there's a lot of things that are literal in Volt Sisters from that sense of place. And then, going back to it and be like, okay, what am I interested in exploring here? What do I think? Like, what would it be like to live here all year round? I'm very interested, again, like I said, in love stories, non-traditional, not romantic necessarily, usually not romantic. And so I was like, okay, female relationships are very interesting. I don't have a sister, I have a brother, but I did grow up with another family. So, like a pseudo sister or two in my life. And that relationship between women, the complexity of that, how it can build you up or tear you down, jealousies, all that kind of fraught tension, particularly when you haven't been raised by mature adults. So emotionally mature adults. So I was really, okay, let's get these sisters on this island. And I had thought about, I'd played with a short story before Beatrice and Henrietta had existed, and it just didn't work as a short story.
Yeah, I think I read an interview where you said it started there, and then you were like, it wasn't fit for publishing, and you kind of put it
No, it was
away.
like these big characters
Or
on
maybe
this
that was in the
island.
acknowledgement. I think that was in the acknowledgements, I think.
It might have been. It might have been. Or I don't know how much I've talked about this, but it was like, okay, Beatrice and Henrietta, and then what is happening, and why are they on this island again? What is it like to grow up there? And just kind of throwing it all into the mix. And I knew I wanted to have that child voice, so with them as kids, but I also wanted it to be as adults, fairly not young adults, but 20s coming back to where they grew up and trying to figure out what the hell is going on. So it came out of that. I mean, similar to Tinfoil, right? Which was this one act play, and then you realize it's a bigger thing and you expand it. It was a short story and it had potential, but it didn't work as a short story. So then let's blow this world up. And horror gave me an opportunity to really do that and write this fairly big book and delve into the relationship, family, familial relationships, and but particularly that, the relationships women have with each other.
I mean, it felt, like I said, it felt very Shirley Jackson. It felt very, and I had Gwendolyn Keist on here to talk about her new book, The Haunting of Elkwood, and they're very different books, but there's a similarity in the sense that I feel like you guys are both kind of taking sort of the classic gothic and being like, what can we do to put a very modern, look at it from a very modern sensibility, like with a very modern kind of 21st century mindset.
Well, I don't remember how old she is, but like when I was growing up, right, in those middle school to high school years, it was Stephen King. And Stephen King is excellent and has some good female characters. But you're always trying to figure out, you're like, where in horror, especially then, there was a comic book store in town that was very male driven, male populated. I was reading Sandman, Neil Gaiman. You're trying to figure out, even if it's just in the back of your head, like, where do I fit into this? So then you've got V.C. Andrews, which is delicious, but
I
not
mean
great. No
it is
offense to
what it
anyone.
is.
Anne Rice is getting closer. You're like, okay, this is a little, this is interesting. Sense of place, women. And so you're just, for me, I was just searching. It's like, okay, Shirley Jackson, but it's not quite scary enough. You're trying to find your place in that world that did feel male dominated at the time. And so taking it and being like, I know I have something to say in this realm. And, women understand something about fear that others don't. Those are generalizations, but it's like, okay, what can I do with that? And I wonder if Gwendolyn's got that kind of going on too.
Well, and she's talked about how, like, I think she's not the biggest Stephen King fan. I think we had talked about how she kind of responds more to his short fiction than his novels. And also, like, she really draws a lot, I think, from, like, for her, it was like going back to Poe and stuff.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
And
absolutely.
she like with her novel Reluctant Immortals, she
That's one
really
I've read.
goes,
Yeah.
yeah, she goes, she she goes back to some of like the early gothic stuff. And and again, wanting to put that kind of more of a modern kind of spin on it.
Well, and not to be, Stephen King, I've read like almost everything of his and I like it very much, but especially back then, it felt as a young woman in a good way. He often dealt with, so as not to be too gross, like men going through puberty, sexuality from the male point of view, all that stuff, and all fine and great. But I'm like, okay, where is the nastiness of being female happening in all of this? Because
I
we're
mean,
gross too.
he's even talked about, obviously his big book where he does deal with that is Carrie. And he's talked about that he wrote the first chapter of that and he was completely lost.
Yeah, his wife
And
helped, didn't
his
she end
wife
up
helped him.
helping? Yeah, yeah.
He threw it
And even
away and she dug it out and she was like, "You're onto something, but let me help you
love her,
with this."
Tabitha, I think is her name,
Yeah,
right?
exactly.
So, yeah, exactly. And I think I just watched, I have a 14-year-old daughter who wants to be a filmmaker and likes horror. So it's really fun. We get to watch these things again together that I haven't seen in a long time. So we watched Carrie, and even with the film, which I think is brilliant, I loved it. Again, but that first opening scene in the locker room is such, it's the male gaze 100%. It's like
100%. Yeah.
no one was doing that. That's just not happening. I'm sorry to say, that's a fantasy, a male fantasy. And it's fine. I mean, the movie goes on from there, and my daughter and I talked about like this is clearly this, and then he moves away from it. So, all of it was that. It was that first, it was like living within that locker room scene where you're like, that's really cool, but it's not quite right. And trying to find gain purchase within that scenario. It's like, no disrespect for that filmmaker, no disrespect to Stephen King, but I could tell you something about that scene that you're missing.
Yeah,
We
there's
also
blind
watched,
spots.
yeah, Poltergeist, and there's, I can't remember, there's a teenage daughter in it that barely makes the picture. Like she's just somewhere else half the time. And I'm like, somebody needs to write the movie from that girl's perspective because things are messed up for her. Nobody's paying attention. The construction workers are like about to sexually assault her, and everybody thinks it's hilarious. It's fat. It's just really. It's so, you're trying to fill that space.
Well, and I've heard the same similar critiques of The Exorcist, and
Such
I'm
fun.
I mean,
to
it's it,
watch.
and it's you know, and obviously I'm a dude,
Yeah.
and I've
Great.
become more and more aware of my own blind spots when it comes to these things, and that's one of the things that I appreciate about reading something like The Insatiable Volt Sisters, is it kind of like is I think instructive for me to kind of like open my eyes to like where I have some of my own blind spots. And
Yeah.
you know, as much as I love Stephen King was my, I think for
Oh, I
most of
bet.
us of our age,
Yeah.
he was my gateway drug into the genre,
Yeah,
you know.
absolutely. Yeah.
But I can look back at those books now and be like, well, you know.
Sure. I'm sure he can too, right?
I mean,
Yeah,
I
he's a
th
smart man. Yeah.
he's even admitted it, you know. And so I think, like I say, I look at the Insatiable Volt Sisters and I see a lot of, I can see the kind of the classic gothic at work in
Yeah,
there,
yeah.
but I also see this very modern perspective, I think.
Thank you. Yeah.
And I think, you know, the relationships between the sisters feel very fully realized in a way that even, like I said, even in like Shirley Jackson stuff, even in
Yeah,
something
yeah.
like We've Always Lived in the Castle, you
Yes.
know, I think just feels a little dated in that book, and it feels much more kind of contemporary in
Yeah.
Volt
I'm glad
Sisters.
to hear it.
So,
Well, and also, like, I was reading Jane Eyre. To me, that was horror, right?
yeah,
And
for
the
sure.
relationships between women in that are totally messed up.
And that's one thing that Gwendolyn, obviously talking about Reluctant Immortals, that was her, she
Yeah.
very much wanted to tackle that, you know.
Yeah. And then you've
That
got White
was,
Sylvester
she wanted to
Sea.
kind of
And
reclaim that.
and I loved Jane Eyre. I ate it up. But then you're also like, huh, this is interesting. And Wuthering Heights, you know, like just all these things that were horror stories written by women too that weren't quite hitting the mark. And I think what it makes me so honored to be a part of the horror genre right now is the kinds of perspectives that are being brought to it. So if you're reading horror, you better be reading Gabino Iglesias and S.A. Cosby, and I mean just opening up this kind of stories that can be told, beloved. I mean that's predates me, but it's like I don't have any right to tell. Nobody wants to hear my take on slavery. That would make no sense. But then you give it to Morrison, and it's like, what a gift to somebody like me to get to read that and hear that
Exactly.
and feel that. So there's some just I'm gonna blank, but just the people writing right now, Gwendolyn, I mean, it's just stunning. And to get to be anywhere near that is wonderful.
With one thing that you know, I read your on your website, you have an article, and I have it in front of me here. It's on the haunted lives of girls and women. It's from
Yeah.
Lit Hub.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, you're kind of talking about like thinking about the haunted house story as kind of a construct, but how, but talk about that article a little bit and just kind of your perspective and what you were kind of exploring with that. Because I thought it was a really interesting, and how it kind of relates, I think, to the Insatiable Sisters.
I think, you know, part of I've always been fascinated by by a haunted house, and the idea of a haunted house might not even be a house, right? It might be a generation, it might be a location, it might be the slavery itself, it might be. I was just teaching this. We were watching the very beginning of Jordan Peele's Get Out, where it's just this man, this black man walking down the street of a suburban neighborhood, and suddenly the suburban neighborhood is a fucking haunted house. It's like, this is terrifying, even though it's very prim and clean, and you know, and so I got very interested in that, and I think it stems from feeling growing up female and feeling very much this sense that there are lots of things you're not supposed to do or talk about, places that aren't safe, and often those are housed in your own body or your own understanding of what it means to be female. So walking around feeling the ghosts of everything and not knowing how to identify them, not knowing what's dangerous. I think that was really interesting. And how much power you have. What's the women have tons of power. So when do you take that away from another woman? When do you have it for yourself? And so I just feel like within that construct of being female and how you're told you should be, there's a lot of opportunity for misunderstanding and hauntings and, you know, as a girl trying to read into the room what's really happening. I don't know if that makes sense, but just this really strong sense of wanting to understand what's the underneath of everything. What is the past that we're facing? And when is it real and immediate danger? And when is it old and not so immediate? So really interested in that. And again, like I said, with female relationships, how do we contribute to that? How do we take it away from it? So that's all part of that.
Well, and you were talking also about kind of like the legacy of like the family. You were talking about the legacy of like, your great grandmother and finding out she had gone through these miscarriages, and then these kind of unspoken legacies of like abuse and violence and things that people don't talk. I think you mentioned, I don't remember if you said you saw it or if someone else had mentioned it, seeing a
A
neighbor with
neighbor, yeah.
bruises on her arm, and it's
Well, it
something that.
always, yeah, it just has always struck me that if we were to talk about these things or address them, they become less powerful. So often in a haunted house, the ghost is like of your own making or imagination. It takes you a long time to identify it, to say, this is what I'm seeing. Am I the crazy one or is the world crazy? And with these kinds of issues of inherited trauma or violence, you can diffuse a lot of them by talking about them, but they're so strong that nobody's talking about them. And so then you're talking about something abject like domestic abuse is wrong, but then you're a little kid and you're seeing it and you're like, but it's right there and nobody's talking about it. So I think those kinds of ghosts are often just the secrets we're keeping for our own protection or supposed protection of others. And then they start to come out. And talking to somebody like of my grandmother's generation, it wasn't not a big deal to her that her mother had miscarriages, but it also didn't, it was a different time, so it's a different scenario you have to imagine. But conveying that information to me, I'm like, okay, and what does that mean? And how must have that been? And if there had been conversation about it all along the way, I might know something more than I did when it's just handed to me almost casually. And there is something about the passing down of stories. If you don't do it, things get lost. And as you grow up female, if you're not sharing those things, it's a lot, to me, it was a lot scarier place, right? So when I was pregnant with my first child and I went to the doctor and he's like, well, you might not want to tell people until you're 12 weeks. No one had ever talked about a miscarriage with me before, that was normal. I had heard of them as a massive tragedy. I'm not saying they're not. But then I, slowly from that moment came to find out all these people I knew had been through that, right? But it's a secret. It becomes a ghost. It becomes a something haunted if you don't talk about it.
And it's and reading your article about it made me think about things I've found out over the years about things about my own family, and
Bet.
things about my own grandparents, and my own grandmother who that's not, I don't know any like specific stories of abuse, but one thing I know, like my grandmother, there was just things she didn't talk about, and like she was of such a like wonderful, sweet person, and like her front-facing personality was so joyful, but I've heard things since about traumas, that were just never spoken of. And like you say, those are the ghosts, and by not passing them down, they become the ghosts. And I think that it's such a powerful theme in the Insatiable Volt Sisters, because you have, I think, of the character of Carrie in the Insatiable Volt Sisters, who's Henrietta's mother, and her talking about like how she was just kind of abandoned on this island, and was no one ever explained to her what she was supposed to do, So she's trying to protect her daughter. She's got this husband who she discovers really never really truly loved her the way he was supposed to. She's kind of competing with the ghost of his dead wife, who she looks like. She's trying to raise the daughter of this dead wife while also raising her own daughter, and she's dealing with literal ghosts, and again, without like trying to spoil too much, like maybe a monster on the, I mean, it's there's so much ground, and no one has explained the rules to her, and she's just like, what the fuck do I do?
Well, and I think that's how it feels sometimes to be female specifically, but also just to be growing up a smart, observant person. You're like, what is going on? And why won't you just tell me directly what's happening? And for her husband, for Henrietta's and Beatrice's father, he's also, if we want to take his side for a minute, traumatized and trying to recreate, trying to make up for what he messed up by falling in love with this new woman, and he just wants it all to go away.
Well, and that's something that, and again, reading it from the perspective as a male reader of the book, this is something that I thought you captured very powerfully, and it's something that we don't tend to talk about. Is, if we want to think about some of these traumas, not to become overly political, but I think we can, because I do think you describe the novel as a feminist horror novel, so I
Yeah.
think we can, put it in
We
those
can go
terms.
there. Yeah.
So we can sort of describe the horror. Again, I'm trying to be a little circumspect because I don't want to spoil anything, but as some sort of version of the
Yeah.
patriarchy.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
And is kind of literalized in a literal evil, right?
Correct.
One thing we don't tend to talk about is how damaging the patriarchy is to men.
Yeah, it is.
And the character of James, in some ways is a villain. James Volt, the father,
Yes.
in some ways he's a villain, but in some ways he's kind of a tragic victim as well.
Yes.
And I really found you ha treated his character with a lot of genuine empathy because, he's caught in this kind of just cycle in reliving these patterns that he has no idea how to escape from either. These kind of patterns of violence and I don't know what you would say, like violence and just kind of,
Family history and, men having this, like, you're supposed to pass this on. You got to maintain what we gave you.
Right, exactly.
You got to rule over this situation and know how to handle it and not be, a dumbass and not cry and just like, don't have any friends. Just
Not
make it happen.
communicate.
Yeah, don't communicate. And he's a poet. He also is trying to seek out ways to do that. He's got all this fodder for really good stuff in his life, but he can't access any of it because it's a secret.
Well, and Carrie even has a line where she's looking at her poem, at his poems at one point, and he's kind of just because he never leaves the island,
Yeah.
and she says as his world has gotten smaller, his art has gotten smaller. It's
Yeah.
like
Yeah.
he's just completely like winnowed his own. He's
In his
compartmentalized
room,
himself so small
yeah,
that he's lost touch with everything
including
himself,
his daughters
including his
eventually,
daughters.
and yeah,
Because he has not been able to break free of these patterns. And we use this, there's this overused phrase in culture, toxic masculinity. But I've thought a more accurate phrase might be carnivorous masculinity.
I love it, I love
And I
it.
think this book is like almost literally about carnivorous masculinity,
Yeah, thank you. I like that. That's great.
And I just think you capture that so powerfully.
Well, and then just how we pass it on. Like, white women aren't doing that great either. I mean, we're
Right.
carnivorous in our own way. Like, we're all trying to gain purchase on somebody else's back, and it's so
Well,
gross.
and BB is a great example of that, and again, not wanting to spoil too much, but she kind of gets caught up in it,
Yeah, she's like, let's
as
do
the
this.
older sister. Yeah.
Yeah, let's dominate. I'm on board. I'm
Right.
not born male, but I can do this.
Yeah,
I can
exactly.
eat everybody alive. Yeah. And, I
And even
think.
Sonia is kind of just sort of like going along to get along kind of thing,
She could tell the story. She's a historian. She could say, no, this is what is happening. This is what we're not going to do. This is how we're going to save. And she just kind of decides to watch and observe and then insert herself at
Yeah, there's a lot
inappropriate
of people sort
times.
of shirking their responsibility. And I think it's a very like the tragedy of the or the potential tragedy of the book, I guess I should say, are the decisions. Yes, there's a supernatural threat, but it's the all the different ways that people are avoiding confronting their own culpability and what's being done.
Yeah, their own truth, their own culpability. Yeah, and it's hard. I mean, I think about that as a parent, right? I have two daughters now. Like, when do you say the thing? Do you avoid saying the thing? Traumatize them more or less, and you're flawed as well. So like, and so you don't even see, like, I'm a certain generation. I don't even see some of it, right? So you don't know. So it's interesting.
And I think what I love about the Insatiable Volt Sisters is novel is it's a it's to me it's a perfect example of what we were just talking about earlier is it's an example of where horror can live both on this allegorical level of like there's a lot of big ideas, but also it's a visceral lizard brain horror novel. Like there are some horrifying, I mean, there's again, not wanting to spoil much, but there is a literal monster, monster or devil, yeah, or demon, and yeah, there's an image of it eating molars out of somebody's mouth.
I have teeth. I can't watch anything that happens with teeth. So that's me, yeah, trying to.
I mean, I remember I had forgotten that, and I was rereading it over the weekend, and I was sitting there reading it like cringing as that was happening.
Trying to work through my teeth issues. Yeah. I mean, I just really like that book, just such a gift to have time to write that. It really felt like digging into some of that stuff that I've been thinking about in a way that I could play with, yeah, and process at the same time.
And then I had a writer on recently, Larry Hinkle, and he has another story. He has a short story in his collection called Reaching Bottom. And I talked to him about this, which it also has a quarry pond story. Good. And I was just talking about like one of my biggest, I mean, I have some particular phobias, and I have a particular phobia around like open bodies of water, mm-hmm, and particularly like sinkholes and quarries and stuff.
I love sinkhole.
So like this so just was hitting a lot of my like
spots. Personal discomfort. Yeah, yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It's a very, for me, it was a very squirmy kind of, in just such the best kind of way.
Good. I'm glad.
Yeah, I really love it. I mean, and you know, I've read the book twice now, and I oh, thanks, and actually I loved it even more the second time. I think I felt like I got huge, a lot more out of it on the second read. So
it's so crazy to be, I mean, it feels like I've been writing so my whole life, and only, and publishing short stories and things like that would happen here and there, but to finally get novels out in the world and then like hand them over to other people and get this privilege of, even if they hated it, it's like someone else has, mm-hmm, this thing and had a relationship with it that I couldn't, mm-hmm, fathom existing. It's such an honor and an interesting space to be in.
And just on a kind of, I guess, what would it be like the kind of the making the sausage kind of level? Like, how did that work? Like with Tinfoil Butterfly, how did it go? Like, how did that work to like get that first book out there?
Sold. So I was working, let me think what's relevant to say. I was working, when I got out of grad school, I was offered a teaching gig. I was a visiting, mm-hmm, assistant professor of creative writing, and I wanted to be teaching. Right. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a writer and a teacher. I think I announced that in the fourth grade. That I knew early, and it has stuck. And so I thought the avenue would be colleges, teaching at universities. And that's where I started. But I realized I didn't want to move around. I didn't want to do that whole academia thing. And I found a private school. And so, mm-hmm, I started teaching high school students, which I adored. Mm-hmm. And that career started to grow until I was actually the head of a private high school in Rhode Island.
Okay.
And so I had this big job. I was taking care of a lot of people, or trying to, and doing all this work. And there's another writer there, a mom. She wasn't working there. Her name is Dawn Tripp. She wrote a book about Georgia O'Keeffe called Georgia that's quite good. And she has one out now called, it's about Jackie Kennedy. I haven't read it yet. Anyway.
So the name sounds familiar to me.
She got a lot of acknowledgement for Georgia in particular.
I mean, probably which being is good. In New Mexico, but I
you've
think
probably people heard probably of it and seen it. Yeah. It's great. And I'm going to read her newest one as well. But she is a fellow writer, and she knew that was my secret, not so secret passion, and encouraged me to reach out to her agent. So I got Tinfoil together. I sent it, and it just started, things that had taken forever or hadn't happened, I think, just started to happen. And part of it was where I was in my headspace, what I was willing to do to that book, just tear it up, make it its best version possible, meeting Dawn, the Me Too movement. I had gotten a lot of early rejections because Emma wasn't likable. So all these things fell together, and all of a sudden it was like, yep, let's do this. And then I found my agent, Daphne Durham, who's wonderful. My agent is Kim. Daphne's my editor, and she's the one who said horror, and then we were just kind of off to the races, and here we are.
That's interesting, the whole Emma isn't likable thing, because I had a TV pilot that I was trying to sell. I'd sold a couple TV pilots back in 2013. And then I had another one that I was trying to sell a couple years later, and it had a very dark female anti-hero character. And the pushback I got on the fact that she's not likable, no. And I wonder if I was just a couple years too early on that, because I literally have people being like, can we make her a man? Like that, like I heard that from probably three or four different
How interesting.
executives. And I was like, no, like that was a hard no for me.
Well, I got a lot of really, I mean, at the time, different points in your career, you're like, okay, this is a really lovely rejection. They read the whole manuscript, they wrote me a letter, right, about how great it was, but we just don't know what to do with Emma. We just don't know what to do.
Well,
And then that all shifted.
my whole point was like, look, we've had Tony Soprano, we've had Walter White, we've had all these characters. Why
And
is it
why?
that you can't deal with her? And they were like, literally, it was like, because people don't want female anti-heroes. And this was probably 2016, 2017. So Me
I think
Too happened,
it's,
I think, the next year. So
yeah, you
yeah.
got to go back to
I
it. It's
should.
just like, if we're all equal, then we have to admit that women are also like totally screwed up and nasty as hell and can, run whatever mafia, is out there. I mean, like that is it. That's unfortunately, or fortunately, is part of the equality. We are the monsters as well. So we got to get comfortable with that, I think. And then we'll have some really interesting stuff out there.
Yeah, also I have to say, having read Tinfoil Butterfly, I did not find Emma unlikable, but that
Good.
maybe that's just me.
Well, it could be you and your experience, but it also, I think I'd also got better as a writer. So just to be fair, I think I also was able to kind of negotiate things as I went back to it with a better understanding myself of who Emma was.
I mean, she's a dark sort of
She could have
damaged
done better
characters in a lot
things.
of ways. Make some not
Questionable
great decisions
decisions.
at some point. But they're all, but she's very human, I found. But
Thank
anyway.
you. Thanks.
Well, we should, and again, as always, I ask people to recommend a movie, and you recommended one of my all-time favorites, and I think I can for sure see its influence on the Insatiable Volt Sisters.
Oh,
You
thanks.
recommended the movie Ginger Snaps.
I love the movie Ginger Snaps.
So
It's
we
one of
should
the ones
talk
I
about
just watched with my daughter Violet fairly recently. I was like, oh, we have to watch Ginger Snaps.
that.
And it was really fun to watch it again. I traumatized some poor high school senior once when I was teaching, and he was like, he was about to graduate. He's like, what's your favorite movie? And I was like, Ginger Snaps. And he watched it, and he was like, oh, I didn't expect there to be so much menstrual blood. And I'm like, oh, was there a lot? I don't remember that part. And then I watched it recently. I was like, oh, that's what it's about, Rachel. That's why you liked it. Poor guy. I want to call him and be like, I'm so sorry. I'm naive. But yeah,
So what is
I
it
love
about
it.
that movie that well, I guess we should set that one up. I think most people who listen to this podcast probably have seen it. It's pretty popular with horror fans, but for those who haven't seen it, I guess set it up a little bit.
Well, I think, I think it's Canadian. It's a werewolf movie. It's two sisters. They're the villains and the, heroes in this story. And one of the sisters, right, Ginger,
Ginger. It's Ginger and
gets
Bridget.
Ginger gets bitten by a werewolf, and Ginger fucking snaps. I mean, she is not good, but it was like, for me, it was the first time I felt very connected to that female sister story. Again, very like connected to menstruation and the moon. And like, I had always at that point heard about like, oh, the hardship of being on your period and what that means and blah, blah, blah. And here was something that was just like taking it and turning it up and being like, all right, she's gonna use it to ruin. And in a very purposeful and volatile way. And then you've got the other sister who's like, wait a minute, this isn't who you are. Like, don't do this. And I love the gore of it. I love that sister connection. I think there are follow-ups that I haven't seen where they're in Victorian dress or something. So I didn't want to spoil it by going further, but I just really adored that story.
Yeah, the sequels, I have seen the sequels, and they're not bad from what I remember. I
Okay.
don't remember them that well. The second one is all about Bridget. It's the follow-up. It's like a direct follow-up. And then the third one, it's
Did they go
like,
back in time somehow? I don't
yeah, it's
know.
like back in like Salem Witch Trials days, and it doesn't really
Okay.
make any sense, but it's the same actors, and it's like a totally different story, but it's like, I think it's like almost a like remake of the first movie, but somehow set in like old Salem. It's very weird. It's a very weird
Right.
concept, but
Yeah.
just kind of go with it. But
It was like realizing, oh, I could, we can be the monster as well. Because you feel monstrous in good and bad ways. And to see somebody dig into it was really fun.
Yeah, like how did you discover that movie? Because I remember when that movie came out, there was like a bit of buzz around it. That was probably late 90s, early 2000s. I don't remember the
Correct.
exact year.
I must have seen it in early 2000s because I went to Cleveland. I had a really good friend from Cleveland, Michelle, who also was writing at that time. And I went to visit Michelle and her friend, I can't remember his name. They were like, Ginger Snaps, you have to see this movie. And we watched it in her apartment and just was horrified and delighted by the whole thing. So that has to be, I was living in Ohio. It's like 2001 or something, maybe I saw it. But it was also, that still that kind of like, when somebody handed you a Stephen King novel in middle school, it was like, we got this DVD and we're gonna watch. So it still had that feeling of being secret and against the rules, and like I hadn't heard anybody else talk about it, and no one else I knew would watch it with me, kind of thing. And so it was just fabulous.
I remember watching that. I think I saw it actually in a movie theater in
Gosh, that
Denver.
would be fun.
Yeah, I think it was like
Maybe you were in college. Is
I
that what
think
was
I
happening?
wasn't I must have been in college, because I for whatever reason I was in Denver, and it was at some little art house theater where it was like a midnight movie kind of thing. And I don't think I went with my girlfriend at the time, because I don't think she would have gone. She wasn't into movies like that. Like, that's the type of thing I would have gone by myself, probably. But I specifically went because when I was in middle school, I had a crush on Emily Perkins, who plays Bridget.
What did you see her in?
She played Beverly Marsh in the TV movie miniseries of It.
No.
And so I was that's the kind of nerd that I was, that I was like, I had this crush on her for like a decade. So, and I hadn't seen her in anything since, but I think I had read in like Fangoria, it was like Emily Perkins, who played Beverly Marsh in It, and I was like, I haven't seen her in anything since it. So I was like, I have to see this movie with her in it. And there was like a werewolf movie and all this stuff. And I just remember what I and watching it again, because I just watched it again last night, and I've seen the movie a number of times.
Yeah.
The screenplay, like the dialogue, is so clever. It's so funny and so, but also very real. The relationship between those sisters, I feel like if you were like a kind of weird misfit, sort of gothy kid in
Yes.
that like late
Yes.
90s, early 2000s vein, like you knew
Yes.
those kids, or you might have
Yes,
been one of those
absolutely.
kids, you
Yep,
know?
that's where we were. We were growing up in that. If I was adjacent to it, if I wasn't that sister and it felt like it felt genuine to the female experience and voice and so funny. Heathers had happened. There was that. There was a couple like this thing starting to emerge, and I really connected with it.
And just it's the screenplay is it, the movie's directed by John Fawcett, who I didn't know much about him. I just looked up, apparently he went on to co-create Orphan Black, the TV show Orphan Black.
Oh, I watched that.
Yeah, which I had no idea he was involved with that.
Interesting.
But but the screenplay was written by a woman, which I think very clearly,
You could
because I
tell.
think just the understanding of that dynamic between
Yeah.
those sisters seems very clearly, very fully realized. But there are certain things I love about the way the movie shot, that are, you can tell it's very indie. Like, so much of the movie is shot where like they're not afraid to let, particularly with Emily Perkins, with Bridget's character, Like her hair is just constantly in her face, like blocking her face, which feels very real.
It does. It also somehow very, I don't know, it felt very 90s to me. I was like, oh yeah, that's what was happening. Yeah.
And she's always like just hiding in her oversized trench coat, and yeah. It also feels very
was
super Canadian, like they're always playing field hockey. Like that feels very Canadian to me.
it was, it was. Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, it's
Yeah.
one of the smarter, you know, the special effects are kind of you know, they kind of are what they are, but like it's one of the smarter horror movies of that era, I think, and it really holds up really well.
I was pleased to watch it again. I mean, again, some of the special effects, my daughter has seen much better, but it is so intelligent and fast, witty that, and the relationship is so genuine, and the relationship to their sexuality, the one sister versus the Beatrice versus the Henrietta. I mean, I really drew from that because it strikes me as really very real. So all those things make it still feel current. Right, even if the special effects are, it's a little goofy sometimes, it still was great. And really, some of that stuff, I love watching them when they actually build the monster, right? I rewatched the thing, and it was just like, oh, look at this thing they made. It's in the room and it looks so goofy, but it's also gross, and
I love
I adore
that,
it.
just the tactile practical effects. Even when you
Yeah.
can see, it's like, okay, that's like a bunch of
That's a
latex and
puppet. Yeah.
fake
I
blood.
don't care. I'm like, oh, look at that. How'd they make that? That's neat. It becomes its own little art form. I want more of that instead of less of it. Let's bring back that kind of kitsch stuff. It's great.
And I feel like I haven't read this anywhere, but I feel like that movie had to have been an influence on the movie Jennifer's Body, which came out probably about 10 years
Yeah.
later.
Yeah. We also watched, which is another good one. Yeah, and it very you're right. It has to. There's got to be somebody talking about that because it is the same in a lot of ways. A little fancier, a little prettier. But yeah.
Well, I was glad to rewatch that. It's been a while since I've seen it, so I was glad to to have that recommendation.
Good. I'm glad. I love it.
Well, this was a lot of fun. I was glad to get a chance to talk to you. So what, I don't know if you're allowed to talk about what you're working on now and what we can expect to see from you in the future.
I just finally actually signed a contract. I am and turned in revisions yesterday. I'm a little exhausted by the whole thing, but I'm working on the final touches of a novella that will be out in 2025, and
Oh, cool.
it focuses on motherhood and a woman. It's set in the Sandias,
Oh, nice.
and it's about a woman who, what's the short version? That finally gives birth to a literal monster, and what she can learn from this daughter of hers,
Interesting.
and what comes out of that. So I think that's what it's about.
Cool. So it's a
Yeah.
novella, you said. So it's on
It's
the short
short. It's about
side.
150 manuscript pages.
Cool. And is it going to be like a standalone, like published as a standalone, or is it
Yes, it does reference the Volt sisters, so there's a little connect.
awesome.
Also, I'll say that. But yeah, it's a standalone and I'm like really in the weeds with it. Yes, as of yesterday. So it's hard to think about it real clearly right now, but I think it's getting there. I think it's gonna be good.
Awesome. Well, definitely looking forward to that.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show, and
Yeah.
yeah.
And I don't, I'm so excited to be connected to someone in the same field in Albuquerque. I don't have a lot of that. So we should definitely stay in touch.
Absolutely. Yeah,
Great.
I'm around. So I'd love to grab coffee or something.
Okay, good. Let's plan for that. I'll send you an email. We'll find time.
Absolutely. So.
Okay, great.
All right, well, there you have it. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. And thank you very much, Rachel Eve Moulton, for coming on the show. Don't forget to check out the next episode of Nighttime Logic with Daniel Brom. That's going to be on April 23rd at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. His guests are going to be authors Douglas Ford and Jeff Ford. I'm going to be providing a link to that in this episode's show notes. And of course, if you're enjoying the show, don't forget to go to whatever streaming platform you're using. Leave 5 stars, leave a review, go to social media, spread the word, tell your friends. And I'll be back with you guys again with author Robert Ottone in a couple of weeks.